Well, now it's time to welcome back our resident legal guru, Brian Hughes, who's the consultant solicitor from Shenfield-based Rayner Hughes. So welcome, Brian.
Well, good to be back, Scott.
What a horrible day you've brought with you.
Oh, it's terrible. Absolutely terrible. Yeah.
Now, you were reminding me just now that today is your 24th appearance with these legal tips.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I'm beginning to run out of subjects that we've not yet covered.
Well, I don't think we need to worry too much about that because the law keeps evolving. So there's probably a lot of scope to be revisiting some of the items that we've previously covered and bringing us up to date with any of the changes. But we're not there yet. what have you got that you're going to be looking at today?
Well, I thought it might be useful to look at carelessness and negligence.
Well, that's something I know all about.
So do we all. Yes. And what flows from this, and how in legal terms, submitting people to unnecessary risk amounts to negligence. To illustrate this better, I'd like to mention a specific and very famous case beloved of all lawyers.
All right. But first off, can you give us a bit of general background information?
Carelessness can affect you or it can affect others. Mm-hmm. It can cause harm, inconvenience or loss to you, and it can do the same to others. If, for example, when drying plates after doing the washing up, you drop a plate that is on the floor, that's undoubtedly careless. If you leave something in the oven for too long and it's burnt to a cinder, that again is careless. But both these things and other things like that, albeit negligent, only affect you. They don't affect anyone else except perhaps your guests who are looking forward to a decent meal.
So in other words, no one is affected by that kind of incident.
That's right. But many forms of carelessness can cause harm to others, and not just to yourself. And you may have done something to someone else that, had you thought about it, checked the position beforehand, would not have happened to that person. In such cases, you may well be liable to pay damages to that person. And in legal jargon, that's what you might describe as your fault negligence.
Well, that seems clear enough. So why don't we now look at the case in question?
Okay, but first off, you need to understand that legally speaking, the act of negligence is referred to as a tort. That's T-O-R-T. In the old days, there had to be a direct contractual link between the manufacturer and the person whose health or possessions were damaged before you could sue for negligence. Now, the change was initiated by a very clever judge, Lord Atkin, and his fellow law lords in the famous case of Donoghue and Stevenson. In that case, two elderly ladies decided to spend a day out at a Scottish seaside resort, and after a walk along the promenade, popped into a kiosk on the seafront for a glass of ginger beer. One of the ladies went up to the counter and bought a bottle of it and poured some of it into her friend's glass. She poured some into her own glass and drank it. That's so far so good. She then offered the remaining ginger beer to her friend and poured the rest of the bottle into her friend's glass. But when she did so, the rest of the ginger beer contained the remnants of a decomposed snail.
Ugh.
Shrieks of horror. Shrieks of horror emanated from the friend who thought she might have drunk the rest of the decomposed snail already.
She probably had.
As a result of the friend becoming seriously ill, whether it be from shock or food poisoning, the friend looked around for someone to sue. She couldn't sue the owner of the kiosk in contract because she wasn't the person who'd bought the ginger beer. And she couldn't sue the kiosk owner in tort because he had not been negligent. The ginger beer bottle was opaque and he couldn't have known there was a decomposing snail in it. So the friend sued the manufacturers, who denied her claim by saying that because there was no contract with her, she'd not bought the bottle, there could be no tort of negligence as far as she was concerned. They were only liable to the lady who'd bought the bottle, and she hadn't complained.
So the law was effectively changed as a direct result of this case.
Yeah,
when
indeed.
When was this, and how did that happen?
Well, it certainly was, and this was way back in 1932.
Crikey.
The duty of care concept now affects virtually every aspect of our lives. And it added to that original concept is the rule that you'll be held liable in negligence if you could reasonably have foreseen that damage would result from what you've done, advised, or manufactured. In fact, the concept has been expanded to the point where liability for causing harm to someone or some object can be imposed without any apparent negligence on your part.
Now, you pointed out that this actually occurred in Scotland. So did that fact result in any particular change?
Well, what happened was that first of all, the judge in first instance, I think he had to follow the law.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, well, you haven't got a case because the lady who bought the ginger beer hadn't complained about it. And then she appealed that, and the appeal court said, well, we think that's wrong. And then the manufacturers said, well, we're going to appeal it. So the manufacturers appealed it to the House of Lords in England because it was a Scottish case, and they could appeal it to London. And that's where Lord Atkin popped up and invented the duty of care.
Wouldn't it have been simpler if the first lady who'd actually bought it issued suit? That'd have made it a lot simpler.
Well, she actually hadn't suffered any harm. I mean, she'd drunk it.
Yes.
And she hadn't come to any harm as a result of drinking it. It was just the shock of seeing a decomposed snail in the glass that caused the problem.
Now, as you just said, the concept has been expanded to the point where liability can cause... could cause harm to someone or some object, and that can now be imposed without any apparent negligence on your part. Isn't that a little bit over the top?
Not really. The concept of strict liability has been introduced into many areas. If, for example, you as a conscientious factory owner produces goods, but one of your employees produces defective goods, you or your company, as the owner of the factory, are liable to pay damages. The employee who caused the damage is not liable, but you are liable. The company's liable.
Uh-huh.
The duty of care concept, which was introduced by Lord Atkin and his buddies, has been extended gradually into most spheres, starting with the doctor-patient relationship, hence the number of claims for negligence brought against the NHS, against hotel owners, guests making claims, airlines losing passenger luggage, and so on. It's even seeped into sport, where players are expected to exercise a duty of care and get a red card for a reckless tackle in football or a yellow card in rugby football. League football, for example, or rugby football, that's where their careless actions could cause injury to their opponent. Most possibilities of negligence in the fields of food, drink and goods are now covered by legislation, with fines applicable where there's been a failure to observe minimum standards.
So does that mean that someone who gets a red card or yellow card in sporting action could actually find themselves up before the courts or sued?
Well, technically, if you really injure somebody as a result of a reckless tackle, uh-huh, and you have been negligent, yes, of course.
But presumably there are limits to this duty of care. What do you as the injured party have to demonstrate?
Well, first off, you have to show that the person or company being sued actually owed a duty of care to that individual. Secondly, you must be able to demonstrate that the person or company has breached that duty and failed to reach the standard of care required in the particular circumstances. This assessment is based on the thoughts and actions of a hypothetical reasonable man. Now, hypothetical means that the judges have thought him up, all right? He's hypothetical. It's obvious that any negligent action that doesn't cause damage or loss is not actionable, and that claims for negligence are rarely brought by individuals where damage to the person is temporary. But in certain situations, the state has stepped in and imposed duty of care standards, where fines and penalties are levied against someone careless or negligent. Health and safety, for example, is a case in point. Now, back in 2007, I myself recovered damages from the NHS for misdiagnosing what was wrong with me and nearly causing my death. I wasn't a happy bunny when they misdiagnosed my illness.
Yeah.
Airlines and many other organisations do their best to eliminate any negligence claims by excluding the ability to make them in the small print of their contracts.
Yes, we know all about small print.
Yeah.
So how are the damages assessed?
Well, in 2006, Parliament passed the Compensation Act. It was afraid that application of the duty of care concept might have gone over the top and that society was becoming risk-averse.
A bit like the US.
Yeah. It didn't want everyone suing each other for alleged negligence. It feared that with the emergence of a compensation culture, many worthwhile activities would be curtailed because of the deterrent effect or potential liability. One of the aims of the Act was to address this concern and to serve as a reminder to judges to consider carefully the impact that decisions about potential negligent activity might have in deterring the organisation and pursuit of worthwhile activities. I mean, charities, for example, you know, they'd be dead scared of doing something that might cause negligence.
Of course.
In other words, where potential claims for negligence have not already been taken into account by contractual exclusions or statutory regulations, some scale of potential liability and damages had to be established.
So what did the Compensation Act say?
It started from what this hypothetical reasonable man would have foreseen and what the conduct of a reasonable person would have been in the circumstances of the case. Now, this could depend on knowledge or experience and the state of knowledge of society at the time. The courts have to evaluate the behaviour of defendants, a person or organisation, against whom a claim is made in terms of risk. He, she or it will be adjudged negligent if the claimant, the person harmed, is exposed to unreasonable risk. Because negligence causes a risk of harm, the behaviour of the negligent person or company must be weighed in the balance. The factors to be taken into account are the magnitude of the risk, the social utility or desirability of whatever causes the risk, and the cost and practicability of measures to minimise or eliminate that risk. The courts decide how much weight is to be given to each of these factors and will make a value judgment as to what a reasonable person would have done in the circumstances.
Well, it all seems a bit complicated to me, but from what you're saying, it would appear that the greater the risk to health or harm to someone or their possessions by someone you should have thought about before doing it, the greater the damages, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's about the sum of it. The degree of care which the law demands must be commensurate with the risk created and damages flow accordingly. There are loads of cases on that subject, but to quote just one, while excavating a hole in the street, the London Electricity Board took adequate safety precautions for sighted persons. But when a blind person fell down the hole, the London Electricity Board were liable because the presence of blind people on the pavement was foreseeable and adequate precautions should have been simple to take. Now, look, I've only skimmed over the surface of what is a fascinating and complex subject, one which affects us all in our daily lives, nor have I covered contributory negligence, which is where the claimant is partially responsible for what harm or loss has occurred to them. But I hope what I've had to say has been helpful and has shed a little light on the subject.
Well, of course it is. It always is, Brian.
Well, thank you very much.
So what are you going to be looking at next time?
Well, I think I've had such a run-in on a particular case recently that I thought actually of doing a programme on buying or selling a building plot.
Selling a building plot.
Buying or selling a building plot, because as a residential and commercial conveyancer, I do a lot of this stuff.
Right.
And I think this might be of interest to your listeners.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Brian. Really appreciated that.